This week, the United States abandoned talks on strengthening the 1972 treaty banning germ warfare. Now, biological warfare has become a subject of rising concern in the international community. A recent test revealed that the United States is unprepared for a biological weapons attack, but the Bush administration has rejected new language to enforce the treaty, which lacks specifics on how to limit the production and use of biological weapons. Joining us now to talk about the science and diplomacy of biowarfare is D.A. Henderson, director of the Center for Civilian Biodefense Studies at the Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Henderson ran the World Health Organization's smallpox eradication campaign, and he joins us from member station WJHU in Baltimore. Dr. Henderson, thanks for being with us.
I'm very pleased to be with you.
And Jonathan Tucker, who heads the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Project at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He joins us in our studios. Mr. Tucker, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be here.
What did U.S. policy reject?
Well, U.S. policy rejected an effort to develop a number of measures to strengthen the existing treaty banning biological weapons. That treaty, which was negotiated in the early 70s and entered into force in 1975, just simply banned possession of biological weapons, but did not have any mechanisms of checking that countries were actually complying with the ban or of enforcing the ban. It was decided at a conference in late 1994 that there should be a legally binding protocol or set of measures that would build confidence that countries were complying with the treaty. It was recognized almost from the outset that this was a very difficult task because biological weapons, unlike chemical or nuclear weapons, can be produced in almost any fermentation plant, ranging from a vaccine plant to even a yogurt factory or a brewery. And that led to a failure of the various U.S. government agencies to reach consensus on what they considered to be acceptable measures. Also, a failure to reach out effectively to the U.S. pharmaceutical and biotechnology industries that would be affected by this inspection regime, and ended up with a protocol that we were unable to accept.
Dr. Henderson, I'm wondering if you could take us to school for just a moment. When we talk about biological warfare, what kind of bad stuff are we talking about?
Well, if one wanted to talk about biological weapons, technically any organism or toxin that could be spread around and people and cause disease could be called a biological weapon. But in fact, we would identify really six different organisms as being of highest priority, smallpox being the greatest, anthrax, plague, tularemia, or rabbit fever as some call it, a botulinum toxin, a toxin that produces paralysis, and the hemorrhagic fevers, a group of viruses that cause hemorrhagic disease, Ebola and Marburg are two that are the best known. And one could distribute organisms in food, in water, or by an aerosol, that is, in a fine mist or spray that could be spread over quite a range. Certainly, they can be delivered by missiles, but in fact, I think we feel that our greatest threat comes from perhaps a rogue group or individuals who might release the organisms as an aerosol somewhere, and then you have effectively an epidemic.
Well, what's the significance of this test the United States did not pass last month? I guess it was dark winter is the, military parlance for it.
Yes, it was a special, what we call a tabletop exercise, in which over a two-day period, the episode of a release of an agent and then the beginning of cases is put into a scenario, and it was at a very high level with from the governor of the state to the president to National Security Council and so forth. What happened was that they realized that this was an enormously more complex and problematic situation than they had ever faced before, and they weren't prepared to deal with it.
Does that suggest to you, Mr. Tucker, that it's not the provisions of a treaty that's wrong, it's the lack of individual preparation in the United States to meet that threat?
I think there was a rather strange paradox in the Clinton administration in particular, where President Clinton was very concerned about the threat of bioterrorism, and he began to develop responses. One could argue about their effectiveness, but there was definitely very high-level concern. At the same time, there was very little high-level interest or engagement on biological arms control. And I think because of that, we're seeing the consequences now in the Bush administration's decision.
What about those people who advocate what I will carefully refer to as mutually assured contagion? There are people who believe that the best defense is for someone who uses those weapons to know that a nation, say the United States, has those weapons in reserve as well.
The United States actually decided back in 1969 to abandon our offensive program, which up to that point we had maintained for that very purpose of retaliation and deterrence. But we realized that it was relatively easy for small countries to acquire these weapons of mass destruction, and it was not in our interest to pave the way to develop technologies that could then be used against us. They were a potential threat to us much more than they were to perhaps other countries.
Having covered the Gulf War, I guess I was left with the impression that what restrained Iraq from using those weapons against at least Allied soldiers was the threat of deterrence.
Yes, I think that's the general impression, that that was what deterred the Iraqis from using the anthrax, which they had ready and ready to go. Both the president and the secretary of state intimated that retribution of a very severe form, which was interpreted as nuclear, would be the return if indeed they released the organisms.
So what do we abstract from that finally? Because some people would say the lesson of that is that treaties are not what restrain nations or rogue states or terrorist groups, but deterrence.
Well, I think if we look at this whole problem, I don't think there's going to be any one solution that is really going to assure us that we're not going to have a problem. I think it's going to require acceptance of a norm of behavior that has got to be both at the political level and, I think, is important at the scientific level, where scientists, those in medicine, those in public health, accept the fact that involvement with any of this is really a crime against humanity.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joining us from Baltimore, D.A. Henderson, Director of the Center for Civilian Biodefense Studies at the Johns Hopkins University, and in Washington, D.C., Jonathan Tucker, who heads the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Project at the Monterey Institute of International Studies.